Disc 17.
The Republican primitives would, it was widely believed, use the hearings to tear Marshall and Acheson apart, would make the hearings the great forum they had always wanted to criticize Democratic foreign policy from Yalta to Korea. Who could keep the primitives under control? What senator possessed enough personal fortitude and enough power within the Senate to keep the hearings from turning into a great witch hunt, to allow the other side to be heard? Who possessed prestige and respect so invulnerable that he could stand up to the right-wingers without being himself tarred as soft? Equally important, who could not only control the right-wingers but defeat them? When votes were taken within the investigating committee, who could persuade Southern conservatives to vote for moderate proposals and thereby, together with Democratic liberals, create a majority in the committee? Who could at the same time align with Democrats enough moderate Republicans so that the hearings would not turn into a merely partisan fight that would only further inflame public opinion? No liberal possessed the necessary power and prestige. Who did? Who would lead Congress in doing what it had to do? MacArthur's arguments were sweeping the country, but there were arguments on the other side. Who would bring them out? Who would dare to stand against the tide? This was one of the moments to which Hugh Seide was referring when he wrote that, when the U.S. got into trouble, Russell would stick a forefinger into his somber vest and amble down those dim corridors to see if he could help his country. Everybody watching felt better when he arrived. Republican senators, who would be in the minority no matter which Senate body conducted the hearings, wanted them chaired by a Democrat they could count on to be nonpartisan, impartial, fair. They petitioned Russell to have the Armed Services Committee hold the hearings, so that he would be chairman. As for Democratic liberals, they were aware that unless the hearings were run with a very firm hand, they would become merely another stage on which MacArthur would star, bolstered this time by a chorus of approval from the GOP's Neanderthals. On international issues, if not domestic, they knew, the firmest and fairest hand was that of the senator from Georgia. No other senator, the Democrats felt, could defuse this most explosive of situations. And certainly none of the liberals wanted the chairman's gavel for himself, no matter how great the potential for publicity contained in that piece of wood. It contained also the potential for the political destruction of the chairman, who would, in having to gavel down MacArthur and his allies, be standing in the face of overwhelming public opinion. Democratic liberals also wanted Dick Russell. Russell and no one else. When Tom Connolly claimed jurisdiction for his Foreign Relations Committee, the Senate, confronted with a jurisdictional dispute, ruled that the two committees would hold joint hearings, but that the chairman of armed services, not the chairman of foreign relations, would preside. Although Russell, leader of the Southern Bloc, was regarded as the enemy by most liberals, that did not prevent them from running to him for shelter when MacArthur returned, Reedy says. It was rather amusing to see the speed with which the Senate just automatically gravitated to Russell. Russell knew the necessity of holding hearings. Admiring though he was of MacArthur, the battlefield technician, and even of MacArthur, the theater commander, he understood the terrible dangers of the policies of MacArthur, the global strategist. And he was very aware of the danger inherent in MacArthur's challenge to the president's authority. Russell had, Reedy was to say, a deep sense of the vital necessity of re-establishing the principle of civilian control over the military. And he understood as well the role of the Senate, that the Senate could not be hurried, could not be stampeded, that the Senate was uniquely insulated against the frenzy of public opinion, that the Senate was equipped to be calm, judicious, fair. The hearings, he felt, must not be one-sided. Heated argument was not what was necessary. What was needed was a cool look at all sides of an exceedingly complex issue. Russell believed that what was happening here was a tremendous upsurge of emotion, and that if time was given to look at the MacArthur position, that the ridiculousness of it would eventually become apparent, but would not become apparent if there was an adversary investigation. So therefore it was a question of gaining time so that the American people would really look at it. Russell knew, moreover, that he was the best man to preside over the hearings. He had no false modesty about his expertise on the military and on global strategy, no false modesty about his knowledge of Rome and of Greece and of all the great empires of the past, nor of his ability to evaluate this controversy in the light of history. And he had no false modesty about his stature in the Senate. He believed, says his biographer Gilbert Veit, that he had enough power and influence to direct the investigation along the lines that would be most useful to the country. And he knew he had no choice but to preside over the hearings. He had to do it. It was his duty. He was a Russell of the Russells of Georgia. Noblesse oblige. Hardly had Russell accepted the chairmanship when a dispute erupted that seemed to make utterly impossible the nonpartisan, impartial, calm inquiry he had planned. A dispute over whether the hearings would be open to the press and the public or closed. Part of Russell's desire to keep them closed was as political as that of other Democrats, who, as Time put it, were anxious to keep General MacArthur's thundering rhetoric out of earshot of the microphone and his dramatic profile off the screen of 12 million television sets. But there was something more. The hearings, Russell knew, would center around America's deepest-held military and strategic secrets. "We are entering doors that have been barred. We are unlocking secrets that have been protected in steel safes," he was to say. When it was suggested that he invoke Truman's support for his position, he said there was no need to do so. He knew he was right, he said. "Never talk to Truman about whether closed or open," he scribbled on a telephone notepad. When the Republicans, not the Republicans on his committee, moderate internationalist Republicans like Lodge and Saltonstall, but Midwestern right-wingers like Wary and Capehart, demanded that the hearings be open, he rose on the floor of the Senate to argue against them in words that could have been written by Madison. "I have been disturbed in recent days because of the way we are running the government, by taking action here in response to a quick expression of uninformed desire." It was not, he said, a question of hiding facts from scrutiny. There would be facts spoken and documents discussed about which the communists should not know. "There is something here that is more important than continued tenure in the Senate or even the election of the President of the United States in 1952. Four times the Republicans forced a vote. Each time it was close, but each time Russell won. He wanted as many of the facts as possible released, since he felt that if the public was permitted to see all sides of the argument, the weaknesses in MacArthur's position and the menace of nuclear war which it posed would become obvious, and the emotionalism would die down, the administration would be vindicated, and the cause of world peace advanced. To accomplish this, while safeguarding strategic secrets, he announced that as the stenotypists in the Armed Services Committee room finished typing each page of the testimony, the page would be taken to an anteroom where two censors, one from the State Department, one from Defense, would read it, cutting out any information that shouldn't be released. The edited transcript would then be run off on a mimeograph machine in the anteroom and handed to reporters, who thus could read the testimony, shorn only of sensitive information, within minutes after it had been given. The hearings were scheduled for 10 a.m. in room 318 of the Senate Office Building, the Great Caucus Room, on Thursday, May 3, 1951. General MacArthur arrived almost 20 minutes late. "Couldn't get him down from the cross," one Democratic senator growled under his breath, and strode with a casual wave through a crowd of secretaries and reporters as photographers' flashbulbs popped. The tall doors of the caucus room slammed shut. Three uniformed Capitol policemen stationed themselves in front of them. Gaveling the hearings to order, Russell welcomed MacArthur in the most complimentary of terms. "On the permanent pages of our history are inscribed his achievements as one of the great captains of history. But he is not only a great military leader. His broad understanding and knowledge of the science of politics has enabled him to restore and stabilize a conquered country, and to win for himself and for his country the respect and affection of a people who were once our bitterest enemies." And then, as Time put it, "For three amazing days, Douglas MacArthur sat at the center of the stage to make his case against the foreign policy of his commander-in-chief." He made his case as well as it could be made, with the forceful, colorful rhetoric of which he was such a master. His strategy would not enlarge the war, he argued. On the contrary, it would lead to the defeat of the Chinese communists, force Mao Zedong to sue for peace, and thus produce a clear-cut victory. Of course, he didn't propose invading China with American troops, he said. No man in his proper senses would advocate throwing our troops in on the Chinese mainland. He hadn't been opposing the administration's policy, he said. I was operating in what I call a vacuum. I could hardly be said to be in opposition to policies which I was not even aware of. I don't know what the policy is now. There is no policy. There is nothing, I tell you. No plan, no anything. And, he said, by continuing to fight indecisively, America would incur staggering casualties. It isn't just dust that is settling in Korea, senators. It is American blood. The Truman administration's attempt to make war piecemeal would lead to a broader conflict, as appeasement always did. As to the risk that by bombing Manchuria, blockading China, and using Cheung's troops to invade it, America would push China into the war on a full scale, and perhaps Russia too, he said that the risk of that was small, but that no matter how large it might be, it was a risk that should be taken. I believe if you let it go on indefinitely in Korea, you invite a third world war. And he said it very firmly, the Joint Chiefs of Staff agreed with this view. I am not aware of having had any differences with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on military questions at all. The position of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and my own, so far as I know, were practically identical. To support this contention, he quoted a JCS study which recommended, among other things, removal of the restrictions on air reconnaissance of Chinese coastal areas and of Manchuria. But when the general had finished, the chairman had some questions. Some were about MacArthur's contention that his position had been practically identical with that of the Joint Chiefs. Senator Russell asked mildly, "There is quite a difference between reconnaissance and attack, is there not?" "Yes, sir," MacArthur replied. "Did the Joint Chiefs ever suggest in addition to reconnaissance that these bases be attacked?" Russell asked. "Not that I know of." Some of the questions, by Russell and other senators, including moderate internationalist Republicans like Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. of Massachusetts and Brian McMahon of Connecticut, and Lyndon Johnson in his role as a member of the Armed Services Committee. He had also loaned Reedy to Russell for the hearings, since Russell did not have an adequate public relations man of his own, and Donald Cook and Gerald Siegel were drafting questions for committee members, were about the specific proposals MacArthur was making, and they brought out some implications that MacArthur had not mentioned. Russell's questions were asked in the most courteous of tones. "I do not understand exactly what you would have done about Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist troops on Formosa," he said. And when MacArthur replied, "I recommended to Washington that the wraps be taken off the Generalissimo," the senator had another question. "General, would you mind advising the committee and the Senate what you think is the real strength of the Generalissimo's forces on Formosa?" MacArthur said there were 500,000 excellent men, exactly the same as these red troops I am fighting. Then Russell said, "You feel that if they were landed on the mainland, they could maintain themselves without American help?" This question MacArthur did not answer directly, and Lodge brought up another implication of the proposed unleashing, brought it up also in the most courteous of tones. "What would happen with regard to Formosa if Cheung were to land on the mainland and then be wiped out?" Lodge was asking if America would have to then defend Formosa itself, but MacArthur said, "Senator, that is a hypothesis that is very difficult to speculate upon." In his dramatic speech, MacArthur had assured the Senate that if the Chinese were driven out of Korea, Mao Zedong would sue for peace. But he was asked now, what if Mao didn't sue for peace? Suppose when the Chinese were chased back across the Yalu River, they refused to sign a treaty. What then? What if they massed near the river on their own territory, forces that could be used for a new offensive in Korea? MacArthur refused to take that premise seriously. "Such a contingency is a very hypothetical query. I can't quite see the possibility of the enemy being driven back across the Yalu and still being in a posture of offensive action," he said. But the senators did not let the matter drop, and by the end of that line of questioning it had begun to be clear that at least a strong possibility existed that MacArthur's proposals would have drastically widened the conflict. And, of course, China was not the only opponent that might be drawn into the war if MacArthur's policies were followed, as Russell, speaking in his calm, courteous voice, brought out. "Tell me, General," he said, "if the United States were, hypothetically, of course, to have to aid Cheng's troops on the mainland of China, if, hypothetically, the United States were to be forced to assume the defense of Formosa, if the United States was busy fighting China, what would happen if Russia then attacked Japan?" And when MacArthur said, "I do not believe that it would be within the capacity of the Soviet Union. I believe that the disposition of the Soviet forces are largely defensive," Russell asked quietly, "How about the submarine strength of the Soviet in that area?" And Russell asked, "What if Russia, seeing her allies being defeated, decided to enter the war on a larger scale? What if she attacked in Europe? What if she launched an atomic attack? If we go into all-out war, I want to find out how you propose in your own mind to defend the American nation against that war." "That doesn't happen to be my responsibility, Senator," MacArthur replied. "My responsibilities were in the Pacific." "Did the general know the number of atomic bombs the Russians possessed?" McMahon asked. "No," MacArthur said, "he did not." "Do you think that we are ready to withstand the Russian attack in Western Europe today?" McMahon asked. "Senator," Douglas MacArthur said, "I have asked you several times not to involve me in anything except my own area. My concepts on global defense are not what I am here to testify on. I don't pretend to be an authority now on those things. I have been desperately occupied on the other side of the world." "That was the point," McMahon said. "The Joint Chiefs and the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, has to look at this thing on a global basis and a global defense. You as a theater commander, by your own statement, have not made that kind of study, and yet you advise us to push forward with a course of action that may involve us in that global conflict." By the end of the 3 days, even Time had to admit that, when General MacArthur replaced the hat of a theater commander with the hat of a global strategist, he seemed less sure of his ground. Among themselves, as William Manchester reports, the committee members agreed that MacArthur's bold proposals were unrealistic. And when MacArthur had completed his testimony, with, of course, a compliment from the chairman, who praised his patience, thoroughness, and frankness, there was no praise for his wisdom, another general of the army, George Catlett Marshall, entered room 318 to sit before the senators. He was dressed in a civilian's gray suit, as if to symbolize, as Time put it, the civilian authority of the Secretary of Defense. And he testified for 5 days, calmly, carefully, even ploddingly, in a flat, unemotional voice and sparse phrases that contrasted sharply with his antagonist's flow of words and orotund delivery, and that fit in perfectly with the judicial atmosphere the chairman had established. By the end of the 5 days, the secretary's testimony and the senator's questions had made clear that, at the very least, the question of escalating the war in Korea was far more complex than it had seemed when MacArthur first charged appeasement and said there was no substitute for victory, no policy, no plan, no anything. Russell led Marshall through testimony that showed that the administration did have a policy: to contain communist aggression in different fashions in different areas without resorting to total war. That policy, Marshall said, had worked in Berlin, it had worked in Greece, and it would work in Korea. Despite MacArthur's ridicule of limited war, Marshall said, MacArthur's proposals might well mean formal Soviet intervention. Contrary to MacArthur's contention that the Soviets did not have sufficient forces in the Far East to pose a real threat, Marshall said they had plenty, not only a submarine fleet, but a considerable force in the vicinity of Vladivostok, Darien, Port Arthur, Harbin. In a very quiet voice, Russell asked Marshall to tell the committee what might occur if the Soviet intervened, and with Marshall's reply, there were suddenly, in the caucus room, new realities. That would immediately involve the defense of Japan, Hokkaido in particular, attacks on our air all over Japan, all over Korea, and we couldn't accept that without the maximum retaliation on our part, which inevitably means a world war. And a world war might well mean nuclear war, and the end of mankind. My own view was, and I think it is similar to that of the chiefs of staff, that we were risking a hazard that had such terrible possible consequences that what we would gain was not comparable to what we were risking. The contest between these hearings and the usual headline-hunting Senate investigation could hardly have been greater. The method of releasing quickly edited transcripts turned what could have been a circus, the typical senatorial investigative circus, into what White was to call a proceeding, quiet, unruffled, orderly, and strangely at variance with the investigative habits of the institution. The hearings, White was to say, in an opinion echoed by Revere and other Washington correspondents, dramatically increased the public understanding of the Korean War, of the Cold War as a whole, and of arguments for and against a policy of containment as opposed to that of all-out war. And this detailed presentation of facts and complexities had the effect of calming the waves of public indignation stirred up by MacArthur's clarion call. Soon, Revere was writing that it is possible to discern a slight dropping off of interest in the hearings. The calm would, during succeeding weeks of testimony, be maintained by Richard Russell. Never had the respect in which he was held within the Senate been more evident and more significant for America than during these weeks, in which other generals followed Marshall to the witness table. Every outburst of rage by the Republican reactionaries, every maneuver they attempted as they saw they were losing, shattered against it. When Senator Wiley, attempting to drag Truman more directly into the controversy, demanded that General Omar Bradley, head of the Joint Chiefs, reveal the contents of his conversations with the President about the Korean War, Bradley refused, and Wiley, Noland, and the other conservative Republicans exploded. "I am asking the chairman to rule that my question should be answered," Wiley said angrily. But the chairman ruled, calmly, that a private conversation between the President and the Chief of Staff as to detail can be protected by the witness if he desires. Wiley's rage boiled over, accusing the Democrats of a frantic desire to cover up and whitewash. He was to charge that Russell's support of executive privilege had drawn an iron curtain over the investigation. Wiley said he would demand a vote by the committee. But his demand was not supported by Lodge or Saltonstall or by another Republican, H. Alexander Smith of New Jersey, who said that he wanted to compliment the chairman on conducting the hearing on the highest possible plane of fairness. The vote upheld Russell 18-8. The leaking that would normally have accompanied closed hearings had been drastically reduced by the committee's new method of releasing the testimony. But in the early days, some sensitive information did find its way to the press. Every half hour or so, Revere noted, Senator McCarthy pops out of room 318 to brief his favorite correspondents. Russell reduced it further. When some of Marshall's censored testimony found its way into newspapers, Russell said he wanted to say a few words to his colleagues. All the testimony except that which would endanger American men fighting in Korea was already being released through those edited transcripts, he said. He was sure, he said, that no committee member, that no senator of the United States, would deliberately give a reporter, and thus the enemy, information that would endanger American soldiers. But, of course, there was always the chance of a careless word, a slip of the tongue. And if American soldiers were endangered by such carelessness, he said, neither God nor our fellow citizens will ever forgive us. He paused for a moment, and the full power of Richard Russell's personality was there in the Senate caucus room. "Nor would we deserve forgiveness," he said. Russell led Bradley, a World War II general almost as respected by the American public as MacArthur, slowly and carefully through an explanation of the flaws in MacArthur's proposals, and, thanks to the transcript release method, Bradley's testimony was carried in newspapers across the country. On the sixth day of that testimony, Burke Hickenlooper said he had a proposal. "The hearings were consuming so much time," he said, "why not skip the other three joint chiefs?" In doing so, as Time reported, Hickenlooper conceded that the Republicans had just about abandoned their hope that the hearings would find the Joint Chiefs siding with MacArthur against the President. The proposal might well have carried the day had another senator been chairman of the Joint Committee. Its conservative members had a political interest in cutting the testimony short. As for the others, they had already been hearing testimony for almost 3 weeks, and it was becoming apparent that more long weeks of testimony, weeks during which their presence would be required, lay ahead. But, as Time reported, Russell put it up to the committee, and the committee, by a 14-11 vote, decided nothing doing. It would keep going down the line of witnesses in turn. The chiefs of staff who followed Bradley, Hoyt Vandenberg of the Air Force, Forrest Sherman of the Navy, and J. Lawton Collins of the Army, made clear that MacArthur's claim of their support was, by the most charitable interpretation, a misunderstanding on his part. One by one, William Manchester writes, officers who admired MacArthur seated themselves before the senators and sadly rejected his program for victory. Day by day, as time put it, the glamour, excitement, and anger of the first weeks of General MacArthur's return subsided. The public, or at least a large part of it, admitted that things were more complicated than they had seemed. It was Russell's demeanor, rather than any specific vote or ruling, that made the tone of the hearings thoughtful, judicious, senatorial. It was difficult for even a Wiley or a Hickenlooper to shout for long when the chairman was so quiet and courteous and considerate of every point of view, when he introduced each witness with so glowing a recitation of his accomplishments and qualifications. When in mid-June the time for Dean Acheson's testimony arrived, Capitol corridors were charged with political tension, Time reported. "Wait until we get Acheson," the more partisan-minded Republicans had crowed. But, as Time reported, once the committee doors swung shut, Acheson's questioners, Republican as well as Democratic, settled into the attitude of grave decision that had dominated the investigation from the start. The Republicans, however noisy the blood cries of their colleagues outside, were courteous, dispassionate, and earnestly in search of answers. A calm seemed to settle over the hearing room. Not in years had an investigation in which feelings ran so high been conducted in so temperate and fair-minded a fashion. The torrent of mail that had inundated Capitol Hill became a stream and then a trickle, decreasing as rapidly as if it had been water turned off by a tap. The onlooking senators in the audience melted away, and then the attendance of members of the Joint Committee began to decline. By the last week in May, when, Time said, the dramatic thunder and lightning of the big MacArthur hearing had settled into a steady drizzle of repetitious questions and answers, and testimony was nearing the million-word mark, and there were still many witnesses to come, the caucus room was no longer needed, and the hearings were moved into the Armed Services Committee's room, where, small though that room was, there were soon vacant seats. As for the tenor of public opinion, a baseball game was again the barometer. In April, before the start of the Senate hearings, President Truman had been booed at one for firing MacArthur. Now, in June, MacArthur attended a game at the Polo Grounds in New York and left between innings to the strains of Old Soldiers Never Die, striding briskly across the diamond toward the center field exit, until one fan yelled in a Bronx accent, "Hey, Mac, how's Harry Truman?" And the crowd burst into laughter and applause. A group of Texas oil barons flew into Texas for a speech in a 70,000-seat stadium that was supposed to be the kickoff to a MacArthur presidential boom, but only 20,000 of the seats were filled. There was one more triumph, one more quiet triumph, for Russell. It came over the question of a formal committee report on the hearings. He didn't want one. He had attempted to keep the hearings as free as possible from political controversy, and to a remarkable extent he had done so. A report was the last minefield. "It can only serve as a textbook for political arguments," he scrawled on his desk calendar. So what he did, at the conclusion of the hearings, was, essentially, nothing. Pleading his work on the Agricultural Appropriations Bill as an excuse, he did not convene a committee meeting to consider the question of a formal report until August 17th, almost 2 months after the hearings had ended. At this meeting, he advised against issuing a report, saying that it would inevitably reflect a division of opinion, and that any division might affect truce negotiations in Korea. Noland, Wiley, and three other Republicans objected. The vote against them was 18-5. On a motion by Saltonstall, the committee then decided to simply transmit the hearing transcript to the full Senate without comment. 8 of the committee's 11 Republicans later issued a statement criticizing the conduct of foreign affairs in the Far East. It received relatively little public notice. No formal report or any other action resulted from the long investigation. Yet the investigation had had a profound effect. As William White was to put it, without rejecting outright a single MacArthur policy, without defending at a single point a single Truman policy, Without accusing the general of anything whatever, the Senate's investigation had largely ended his influence on policymaking. It had set in motion an intellectual counterforce to the emotional adulation that for a time had run so strongly through the country. It had done, in short, precisely what the Founding Fathers had wanted the Senate to do, what their Constitution had designed it to do, to diffuse, cool off, and educate, to make men think, recall them to their first principles, such as the principle that in a democracy it is not generals but the people's tribunes who make policy. It was, in all truth, a demonstration of what the Senate at its best was capable of doing, White was to say. And the Senate, as Samuel Schaffer said, had been at its best largely because of Richard Russell. It was his power and prestige, employed at a moment of great crisis in America, that had calmed a country that was as close to a state of national hysteria as it had ever been in its history. He had displayed, Life magazine said, firmness, fairness, and dignity almost unmatched in recent congressional history. Lyndon Johnson played a minor role in the MacArthur episode, a role that had no relationship to his new post as assistant leader. He had assigned his two preparedness attorneys, Donald Cook and Gerald Siegel, to analyze each evening that day's testimony and prepare a list of questions for Russell to ask the next day. Before the hearings, Russell had not understood about staff in the modern sense. But for weeks now, when he arrived at his office in the morning, there on his desk had been the analysis and the list, tools prepared not by old-style Senate staffers, not by tired old military officers put to pasture on Capitol Hill, but by keen legal minds. Before the hearings, Russell had not understood about public relations in the modern sense. But Johnson had suggested that George Reedy each evening write a statement that Russell could deliver at the opening of the next day's hearings. For weeks now, Reedy's opening statements had been there on his desk. Russell now understood, moreover, that staff could mean more than questions and press releases. Richard Russell had never had an assistant like George Reedy. Sometimes they would be alone together in Russell's office in the evenings, and Russell found himself discussing the strategy for the hearings. Not specific questions or press releases, not matters of tactics, but the overall strategy. And he found that Reedy was worth discussing strategy with, that it helped to bounce ideas off him, to get other sides of the issue. Reedy, the flaming Wisconsin liberal who had always despised Russell because of the Georgian's views on civil rights, had come to realize that Russell was not only the preeminent senatorial tactician, but that he possessed a grasp of history that was equaled by very few politicians in my memory. And Russell realized that Reedy, too, possessed quite a grasp of history. He came, almost despite himself, this senator who had never relied on staff, to rely on Cook and Siegel and Reedy. One day, noticing that Russell never delivered the opening statements he was preparing, Reedy didn't bother to write one. "George, please do it," Russell said. "You don't realize something. I may change it, I may not use it at all, but it gives me a sense of reassurance to know that when I come down that statement is going to be there." Reedy did so, of course, and he began to see that while Russell might not deliver the statement as written, he managed, in making his own statement, to incorporate most of Reedy's points, just as, in asking questions of MacArthur and Marshall and Bradley and Acheson and the Joint Chiefs, he either used or incorporated the questions prepared by Cook and Siegel. By the conclusion of the MacArthur hearings, Russell understood the importance, the necessity of staff, of the way in which it could enable a senator, could enable the Senate, to deal with new complexities, the complexities that had been overwhelming senators and Senate. He understood the importance of this tool in modern politics. He understood because of Lyndon Johnson, and he had seen that Johnson was a master in the use of this new tool, as he was a master in so many other new tools. He saw that Johnson was capable of adapting the Senate to the new age. And, of course, during those weeks in which Russell had been using the questions and statements provided by Lyndon Johnson's staff members, it had only been natural for him to discuss them with Johnson. The two men had worked over them together at breakfast in the Senate dining room, and often in the evenings, so that they often had not only breakfast, but dinner together. Their relationship, already close, had become even closer. By the end of 1951, George Reedy says, the Russell-Johnson relationship was a very, very close relationship. And it was about this time that Richard Russell paid Lyndon Johnson quite a compliment. In an undated memorandum that appears to have been written in November or December 1951, a Time reporter informed his editors in New York that Russell has soberly predicted that Lyndon Johnson could be president and would make a good one. Chapter 17. The Nothing Job. The presidency, of course, was never far from Lyndon Johnson's mind. After his election as assistant Democratic leader in January 1951, Leslie Carpenter had written that to Johnson and his admirers, his selection as majority whip was just one more step on the road to the vice presidency, and perhaps one day to the White House itself. The Texan makes no particular secret of his ambitions in that direction. But the path ahead was still a very long one, and if Johnson had few illusions about the position of Democratic leader, he had even fewer about the position of assistant leader. "The whip's job is a nothing job," he told journalist Alfred Steinberg. If he was to advance along that path, however, his progress during the next 2 years at least was going to have to be through that nothing job. So he had set about making, out of nothing, something. While, during these 2 years, 1951 and 1952, the Senate had, in the MacArthur hearings, a moment of glory, over the rest of those years hung a miasma of gloom. The century-long decline in its power and prestige accelerated. Hardly had the 82nd Congress convened in January 1951, when President Truman announced that he was sending, without reference to Congress, and without any emergency to justify the decision, 4 more divisions to reinforce the American army in Europe. This was not sending a few Marines to some Latin American banana republic. This wasn't a murky question of whether the dispatch of troops was interposition or intervention. Never before, as Arthur Schlesinger was to write, had a president claimed constitutional authority to commit so many troops to a theater of potential war against a major foe. Truman didn't merely claim the authority, however. He flaunted it. Even while Senate business was being dominated by a great debate over whether or not to give him permission to do what he had already done, the president said of Congress, "I don't ask their permission, I just consult them." Not, he added, that he was required even to consult, unless I want to, but of course I am polite, and I usually always consult them. Opening the debate, Robert Taft said the president simply usurped authority in violation of the law and the Constitution when he sent troops to Korea. And, without authority, he apparently is now attempting to adopt a similar policy in Europe. But Tom Connolly replied that the president had authority as commander-in-chief to send the armed forces to any place required by the security interests of the United States. For 86 days the debate rolled back and forth, but when Dwight Eisenhower, who had been the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe during World War II and was considered an unchallengeable authority on military questions, testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee that there was no acceptable alternative to the defense of Western Europe but to send the 4 divisions, the debate was effectively over. Attempting to save some face, the Senate resolved that it was its sense that Congress should be consulted before future presidential decisions to send troops abroad. What this foggy final paragraph meant no one seemed to know, one observer commented. But it approved Truman's decision, and, as fortune put it, the effect was to loosen still more Congress's none-too-firm grip on the sword, thus bringing about a definite relinquishment of some of its constitutional authority. These 2 years were years of investigation. Johnson's Preparedness Subcommittee and Estes Kefauver's Organized Crime Subcommittee were only the most famous of a score of congressional investigating groups actively looking into Truman's administration, into atomic spying, into a host of other areas. And hardly had Russell's hearings, which burnished the Senate's reputation, concluded when Joe McCarthy removed the luster and lacquered on tarnish by speaking on the Senate floor of a conspiracy so immense. And thereafter, throughout these 2 years, McCarthy's influence on the Senate grew. With the Korean War still dragging on, Congress at least passed some foreign affairs legislation, authorized increased military expenditures and non-military aid. On the domestic front, as one observer noted, Mr. Truman's Fair Deal program scarcely got discussed. When the national legislature finally ground to a halt in October 1952, it had, the Washington Star said, completed less work than the 80th Congress, the Congress called the worst by Truman. The Washington Post reported that almost as many major bills have been sent back to committee as have been reported to Congress in the first place. In the House, there was at least some leadership, thanks to the commanding figure of Rayburn. The Senate was in almost total disarray. "Congress is being overcome by its own inertia," said Fortune. "The legislative machinery, which is the heart of democracy, is breaking down." The era's most authoritative work on Capitol Hill, the 689-page The Legislative Process in Congress, was being written even as the 82nd session was going forward. Its author, the political scientist George B. Galloway, concluded that many people are losing faith in American democracy because of its repeated and prolonged failures to perform its implicit promises. Although both houses of Congress were indicted for failure, the focus of criticism was gradually shifting to the Senate. In part, this was because of its larger role in foreign affairs. Now that the United States has become the leading democratic world power, the future of the Senate is a subject of general concern, Galloway wrote. The quality of its performance and the nature of its output have worldwide repercussions. And in part, it was because of its role in domestic affairs. The absenteeism that had plagued majority leaders Barclay and Lucas was even worse under McFarland, so the body couldn't even pass urgently needed domestic legislation on which both parties agreed. When, for example, increased federal financing of medical facilities, a measure supported by both parties and favorably reported by the Senate Labor Committee, was brought to the floor, so few of its supporters were present that it was defeated. The passage of time had had its inevitable effect on the seniority problem. The Senate Appropriations Committee had become a particularly notorious bottleneck because, as Drew Pearson reported, "Tennessee's never-say-die Kenneth McKellar, grandpa of the Senate, is now so feeble that he can no longer run the committee, which passes on all the funds for the entire government. Yet he is so jealous of his powers as chairman that he won't let another senator run it." And then there was the Senate's peculiar institution. "The responsibility for Congress's failures," Galloway wrote, "lies in large part at the door of Senate filibusters. Filibusters have delayed for decades the enactment of social legislation passed by the House of Representatives and desired by a majority of the American people." Neither Galloway nor any other realistic observer saw any substantial hope of even modifying, much less abolishing, the sacred senatorial tradition of unlimited debate, or of passing other needed procedural reforms. Despite almost universal disapproval of the seniority system, Senator Mike Mulroney was only expressing another universal sentiment when he said that any Senate majority leader who suggested a substitute for that system would be cutting his political throat. Mounting concern was expressed on the Senate floor. "The Senate of the United States has in recent years been losing its hold on the confidence and respect of the American people," Senator Morse said. "The complaint is universal." Condemning the blind rush to pass legislation in the session's closing days, the acting minority leader, Republican Guy Corton, said, "We are mighty close today to acting not as a parliamentary body, but like members of a group in a riot. I feel that I am part of a vast failure of public duty." There was even being heard, still faintly but with increasing insistence, the suggestion that perhaps America no longer needed a Senate, that in a modern world a Senate might be an anachronism, as Galloway put it, a relic of the days when checks and balances were needed to prevent tyranny, that perhaps the Senate's powers should be reduced, or that perhaps the Senate should be abolished entirely. That, Galloway pointed out, would only be in keeping with a worldwide trend. "The decay of second chambers and the trend toward unicameralism in the democratic constitutions of the post-war world are widespread phenomena." 29 democratic countries now had unicameral legislatures. And perhaps that would be the fate of America's Senate, too. The obsolescence of the Senate, so the argument runs, together with its tolerance of unlimited and irrelevant debate, and its frequent absenteeism, may lead the American people in time to recognize that their second chamber is not indispensable, Galloway wrote. The predictions that inoffensiveness and amiability would prove insufficient qualifications for the job of Senate Majority Leader had been borne out, embarrassingly, at Ernest McFarland's very first encounter with the press following his election to the post. When the reporters crowded around the four Democratic congressional leaders, House Majority Leader John McCormick and Whip Percy Priest, McFarland and Johnson from the Senate, as they emerged from their first Monday conference at the White House, asked likable old Mac for a statement, he stammered for a moment and then said, John is more experienced at this than I am. McCormick and the reporters reminded him that the statement traditionally came from the Senate leader. Well, McFarland finally said, the president expressed confidence in Congress and what we can get done in the next 2 years. Only when reporters pressed him did he think to add that, of course, I share his confidence. I think we will be able to work out a unity that will be good for the country. McFarland seemed to have forgotten a piece of news that the conference participants had agreed should be told to the press. When Lyndon Johnson whispered a reminder, McFarland told him to make the announcement himself, and Johnson thereupon stated that his Preparedness Committee would start hearings on the Selective Service Bill that week, and that General George Marshall will make the first statement. Only then did McFarland remember what he had been supposed to say to demonstrate Democratic unity on the draft issue. The president emphasized that General Marshall's proposal will be an administration proposal, and Marshall will speak for all departments and agencies of the government. If you hear any rumors to the contrary, they are not true. And he delivered that message with the air of an actor trying to remember difficult lines. McFarland was not to improve with practice. It was soon an open secret on Capitol Hill that old Mac just couldn't think very fast on his feet. Nor was this man who said, I just try to get along with people, adept at the exercise of power. When a senator, even one whose vote was crucial, told him that he was going to vote against an administration proposal, McFarland's standard response was, That's all right. I'll never ask you to vote against your convictions. As William White was to say, there are not many times when a Senate leader can afford to get tough. To McFarland, there was no time at all. And, of course, had old Mac wanted to exercise power, he didn't have much to exercise. Though he was called the Democratic leader, more than half the Democrats took orders not from him, but from Richard Russell. And should it come to a showdown involving the entire Senate, a majority would take orders from Russell and Taft. The conservative coalition, not the administration, had the votes in a crunch. Liberal senators and the president might insist that he get a bill out of a committee that was letting it die by inaction, but what was he to do when the committee chairman flatly refused even to put the measure on the committee's agenda? Obtaining a majority vote for a motion to discharge a bill from a committee would be all but impossible. And if a liberal measure did somehow reach the floor, what was the majority leader to do then? Once, with Truman demanding that a bill giving home rule to the District of Columbia be brought to a vote, McFarland gingerly raised the subject with the Southerners, who informed him that should the bill reach the floor, they would discuss it at length, because, as one Southerner put it, home rule would open the door for a Negro mayor of Washington. And where was McFarland to find the votes to shut off the filibuster? He let the Home Rule bill die, he had no choice but to let it die, in committee. Day after day, the genial, inoffensive Arizonan had to listen to the Douglases and Lehmans pillory him to his face for inaction, had to read, day after day, that McFarland was simply ineffectual, or that Majority Leader McFarland was no leader at all. There was nothing he could do about it. The number of senators on the floor, for years so disgracefully small, grew smaller. Endless quorum calls were required to round up enough senators to conduct even routine business. In August, McFarland convened a caucus of his Democratic senators. At the Senate's present pace, he said mournfully, we'll be here until Christmas. The useless quorum calls, he said, were wasting the equivalent of one day a week. It's got to stop. Not an hour after the caucus adjourned, he went to the chamber. The first voice he heard when he opened the doors at the rear was that of one of his Democrats, calling for a quorum. When he did manage to get a measure to the floor, even a non-controversial measure on which no one wanted to filibuster, he could not put a halt to speeches, often on some unrelated topic, designed for home consumption. In September, with the Washington Post saying that Congress is taking longer to pass fewer bills than it ever did in recent history, he took the floor and, as the Post reported, pleaded with senators to stop talking and start voting so that we can get out of here. He is, the Post said, getting positively plaintive about it. By the end of his first year as leader, McFarland was a figure of ridicule in the Senate and in national publications as well. Although the failure of the congressional leadership, in particular of the Senate leadership, was a theme much emphasized as the 82nd Congress drew to a close, the leadership referred to was that of McFarland and the committee barons. None of the criticism included Lyndon Johnson, for he was not considered part of it. His title, assistant leader, had always been little more than honorary. Journalists had the impression that the whip's job was still the nothing job he himself had called it. Johnson was careful not to disturb that impression. While he was still photographed emerging from the White House, after that first Monday morning, he seldom, if ever again, made the mistake of injecting himself into the exchanges between the leaders and journalists. He stood silently in the background with his House counterpart, Priest, as McFarland and McCormick answered, or tried to answer, reporters' questions. When reporters called him off the Senate floor or interviewed him in his office, he took stands on no subjects other than those that dealt with preparedness. Sometimes he would be asked by the White House or by McFarland to persuade a senator to vote for an administration measure, but he almost invariably demurred. Resurrecting a sobriquet from Johnson's past, Drew Pearson wrote that he has adopted a policy of antagonizing no one, a policy which has won for Lyndon the nickname of Lying Down Johnson. But that barb was drowned in the wave of publicity for the Preparedness Subcommittee and for the Watchdog-in-Chief. 1951 was the year of the long profiles that climaxed in the Newsweek cover. Most of those articles concentrated on the subcommittee chairmanship. Almost no attention was paid by the press to Johnson's other job as party whip. That job was not, in fact, so much as mentioned in the Newsweek article. But within the private world of the Senate, in the cloakroom and the marble room and behind the tall closed doors of the offices in the SOB, attention was beginning to be paid, for without the press noticing it, the job was changing. Part of the change was simply a matter of information. Senators wanted to know, needed to know, at what time a roll call vote would occur so that they could be present and have their vote recorded. They needed to know what day a bill in which they were interested would come to the floor so that they could arrange to be present to argue for or against it, to offer or oppose amendments. Not infrequently, they needed to know at least the approximate hour it would come up, which meant knowing if amendments would be introduced to bills on the schedule ahead of it and how much time might be consumed discussing those amendments. They needed to know if a Monday or Friday session would be, as was so often the case, only a brief pro forma session without roll call votes, in which case their weekend fence-building trips back home could be extended. McFarland often didn't know. Overwhelmed by the responsibilities he had accepted, he seemed increasingly helpless as the pace of the session picked up and the backlog of bills mounted. And during the second year of his term, worried about his re-election campaign, he spent more and more time back in Arizona. Lyndon Johnson began checking with the chairman on the status of bills before their committees, and when senators asked about a particular bill, he knew the answer, or said he would find out. And in talking with senators, he acquired as well as provided information. His colleagues found him an attentive listener as they told him about amendments they were planning to introduce in committee or on the floor. And Johnson was therefore able to provide information to the Democratic Policy Committee, of which, as party whip, he was an ex officio member. When that committee discussed issues, he was silent and followed Russell's lead in voting. But when the committee turned to schedules, all of a sudden the discussions were no longer as haphazard as they had been in the past. Johnson could report what amendments were going to be introduced and who was planning to speak for or against them, and how heated and how long the discussion on each amendment was likely to be. And when the schedule had been decided on, he could bring more precise information back to individual senators. There began to be, in the Democratic cloakroom, a realization that now, when a senator needed to know when a certain bill would come to the floor, there was, suddenly, someone he could ask. The information wasn't only about schedules, it was also about votes. The White House needed to know if it had the votes for a bill it wanted brought to the floor. A senator needed to know if there would be sufficient support to pass a measure he had introduced. Vote counting, predicting legislators' votes in advance, is one of the most vital of the political arts, but it is an art that few can master, for it is peculiarly subject to the distortions of sentiment and romantic preconceptions. A person psychologically or intellectually convinced of the arguments on one side of a controversial issue feels that arguments so convincing to him must be equally convincing to others, and therefore, as Harry McPherson puts it, most people tend to be much more optimistic in their counts than the situation deserves. True believers are always inclined to attribute more votes to their side than actually existed. Lyndon Johnson had seen firsthand the cost of wishful thinking, of hearing what one wants to hear, of failing to look squarely at reality, when his father, that man of great optimism, sentimentally attached to the old Johnson ranch, purchased it for a price higher than was justified by the hard financial facts. Lyndon Johnson had felt firsthand the consequences of romance and sentiment every time the reins of the Fresno bit into his back. And Lyndon Johnson had been a master of the vote-counting art for a long time. Of all the aspects of his political talent that had impressed the group of fast-rising young liberal pragmatists of which, as a young congressman, he had been a member, none had impressed them more than this ability. These men, to whom politics was life, were uninterested in party games. At Georgetown parties, while others played charades, they would go off and amuse themselves by trying to predict the exact vote on some bill that would be coming up in Congress that week. And they learned that, as Jim Rowe recalls, he was a great counter. Someone would say, "We've got so many votes," and Johnson would say, "Hell, you're three off. You're counting these three guys, and they're going to vote against you." Says Abe Fortas, "He would figure it out, how so-and-so would vote, who were the swing votes, what in each case, what exactly would swing them." Now, Lyndon Johnson's counting was not a social pastime, but an exercise in hard political reality, and he was still a great counter. He kept his counts on the long, narrow Senate tally sheets on which the 96 names were printed in alphabetical order in a column down the center with a blank line on either side of each name, on the left side for the yea votes, on the right for the nays. When he knew which way a senator would vote, he would write a number, the number that the new vote raised the tally to, on the appropriate side of the senator's name. And no number was written until he knew for sure. To a staff member who, after talking with the senator, said he thought he knew which way the senator was going to vote, he snarled, "What the fuck good is thinking to me? Thinking isn't good enough. Thinking is never good enough. I need to know." Often he didn't know. He had no power to make a senator tell him which way he was going to vote, and some senators didn't want to be asked. Pat McCarran, asked once by Walter Jenkins, warned Jenkins never, ever to do it again. And he never tried to persuade a senator to vote one way or the other. It was information, not votes, that he was collecting. But if he didn't know, he didn't guess. The lines flanking the senator's name stayed blank. In this collecting of information, there had been an important development, what Evans and Novak call the ripening of the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Bobby Baker. Owing a favor to a political operative from the South Carolina hamlet of Pickens, Senator Burnett Maybank paid it in 1942 with the offer of an appointment to the Senate's Corps of Teenage Pages, and the man recommended Bobby Jean Baker, the 14-year-old son of a Pickens mailman. Bobby was working in a drugstore. He had been hired 6 years before to sweep out the place, but, as he was to say about himself, he was an 8-year-old boy who had it in him to hustle, and the store's owner was to say that it wasn't long before Bobby was doing everything but filling prescriptions. One of his teachers said he was so vivacious, just a little trigger. If you wanted something done, you gave it to Bobby, and you knew it would be done. For the first 10 nights the boy was in Washington, he wrote in his diary each night, "I'm so homesick." But when one of his Pickens teachers, hearing of his loneliness, wrote him an encouraging letter, Bobby's reply, scrawled on a lined piece of paper from a notebook, was, "Miss Hallam, Bobby Baker don't quit." And he got ahead in the Senate as he had gotten ahead in the drugstore, in his words, by hard work and hustle. The 22 pages, all boys, wore dark blue knickers, went to school each day in a special school in the Capitol, and on the floor filled the inkwells and snuff boxes in the chamber, brought the senator's public documents, newspapers, telephone messages, or anything they desired. To call us, they'd snap their fingers and we'd scurry to them. He carried out such errands eagerly and sought more. I learned to anticipate what each senator might require. When I learned that a given senator would be making a speech on a given day, I stationed myself nearby to quickly fetch some documents or materials or fresh water as he might need. His favorite senator was Truman. Not once did I see him act imperiously toward lowly page boys. "Young man," he would say, not Sonny as so many called us, "young man, when it's convenient, could you please get me a glass of water?" Before long, senators were asking for him by name and giving him another type of assignment. "Bobby, I'm having a rubdown in the gym. Can you hold the vote for half an hour?" I then would go to another senator, explain the situation, and ask him to request a time-consuming quorum call. He loved the institution. Wandering around the floor, he would open the drawers of the desks so that he could read the names burned or carved into the wood. Running my fingers over the names, Daniel Webster, Stephen Douglas, Andrew Johnson, and marveling that I stood where they had stood. He was very early intrigued by the give and take of Senate debate. When a parliamentary maneuver was underway and he didn't understand it, he would later approach parliamentarian Charles Watkins in his office. He was a kindly, gracious man from Arkansas, and he patiently educated me. So earnestly did he ingratiate himself with senators that at the age of 16 he was named Chief Page, and at 18 he was given a title on the Senate staff so that he, unlike the other pages, might remain on the Senate payroll even after Congress had adjourned for the year. When he married, it was to a woman from the Senate world, Dorothy Comstock, one of Scott Lucas's secretaries. Bobby made the Senate his home, an article stated. He experienced the major episodes of a young man's life under the great dome of the Capitol itself. There he grew into long pants, had his first shave, went to high school, received his diploma, met his wife and courted her. His wedding reception in 1948 was held in the Capitol. Other boys have aunts and uncles beaming at their receptions. Bobby had 5 United States senators. He was truly, reporters said, the child of the United States Senate. When a senator, Walter George, told him to upgrade his name, he did so. A gentleman of the old school who enjoyed being thought of as an elder statesman, he responded to elaborate courtesies. "Bobby," he said shortly after I had turned 21, "you've got a boy's name and now you're a man. It doesn't have enough decorum or dignity. I'd strongly advise you to change it." His father was offended when he changed Bobby to Robert, Baker was to relate, but Senator George was delighted and thereafter treated me in the warmest possible fashion. By 1951, everyone around the Senate knew him, everybody talked to him freely. He knew a lot of Senate secrets, and Baker worked at knowing secrets. As the writer Evan Thomas was to put it, he made it his business to know things: who owed whom a favor, who was drunk, who was on the take, who was sleeping with his secretary. If an instrument was needed for obtaining information in the Senate world, it would be hard to find a better one than this 22-year-old page. And for Lyndon Johnson, Bobby Baker made clear, he would be a willing, eager instrument. The waiter who brought them sandwiches at their first meeting had felt that Baker seemed drawn to LBJ by some invisible magnet, and thereafter the attraction had only increased. "I found him fascinating from that first talk in 1948, Baker was to recall. "I was indeed beguiled by him." He flattered Johnson unmercifully, implored him to give him chores to carry out. Says one of Johnson's staff, "He was an unabashed lackey, a bootlicker. He'd think of all manner of excuses to come in the office and see Johnson, and he'd tell him about all the things he was doing for him, all the little ways he was helping him." A bootlicker, but an agile one, Evan Thomas was to call him. He carried out Johnson's errands efficiently and as quickly as he could, often at a trot. "He would scurry around the Capitol corridors, often scribbling notes as he walked," his biographer would write. "He hunched a bit as he moved, and as a result some people began to call him the Mole," a description made more exact by his face, which was narrow, with a very large nose, which he later had altered, and a forehead and chin which both receded sharply, giving him a pointed-face look. He tried, somewhat unsuccessfully because he was much shorter and stooped, to stand in Johnson's commanding attitude and to walk as he walked. He had better luck talking like Johnson. His voice seemed to take on a bit of the Johnson twang, his biographer wrote. He was to name not one but two of his children, Linda and Lyndon John, after him. Johnson's response was all that Baker could have wished. "You're like a son to me because I don't have a son of my own," he told him. When Lyndon Johnson asked Bobby Baker what was going on around the Senate, the young man always had a lot to tell him, and Johnson took steps to make sure Baker would have even more to tell. He took the unusual step of inviting a Senate staffer to the small dinner parties at 30th Place at which the other guests were senators and journalists. In the intimacy of the dinner table, as Evans and Novak were to write, the men spoke frankly and unguardedly. Sometimes at such parties there would be three or four tables. Johnson could hear only what was said at the table at which he was sitting. With Baker present and at another table, Johnson had a pair of sharp ears there, too. There was another venue in which senators let their guard down, and Johnson installed Baker there as well. Sometime in 1951, Johnson casually mentioned to McFarland and to Maybank that Bobby had been doing such a good job. Didn't they think it would be nice to give him some sort of meaningless title? Johnson even suggested one. Bobby could be an assistant to Skeeter Johnston. He could be called Assistant Democratic Cloakroom. The duties of Baker's new job were nebulous, but the title freed him from the status and duties of Page. And whatever the duties might be, they certainly had something to do with the cloakroom, which meant that Bobby now had a reason to spend a lot of time there. For Bobby Baker, the cloakroom was a fertile field, because, as he himself was to put it, senators felt safe there. No prying newsmen, no constituents, apart from a few exceptions, no staff members need apply for admittance behind those sacrosanct doors, he was to recall. Safe in the cloakroom, senators opened up their heads and their hearts. And now, when heads and hearts were opened, a very sharp pair of ears was listening. It was here I first heard direct from the horse's mouth what senators were considered to be for hire, and to what extent and to whom. I learned one could not presume that just because two senators shared a common ideology or a common state, that they were soulmates. Jealousies played a part, and all the other human factors entered in. Competing wives, distaste for another's lifestyle, class differences, clashing personal goals. 2 years earlier, Lyndon Johnson had summoned Bobby Baker to his office because he had heard that Baker knew where the bodies are buried. During the intervening 2 years, Johnson had learned that Baker was willing to tell him where the bodies were buried. Now he had placed Baker in ideal vantage points to observe the burials. And of course the information Baker thus obtained gave him insight into how senators were likely to vote on a particular bill. The counting of votes on the Democratic side had been the province of Skeeter Johnston, the punctilious, dignified secretary for the majority. Skeeter still counted votes, still gave the counts to Lyndon, still thought it was his counts on which the leadership was basing its decisions. But it wasn't. Bobby Baker had quietly begun making his own counts. He was a very good counter, and not only because of the information he had collected. Bobby, McPherson says, was no true believer. He was not one of those who just can't help but feel that the issue is so clear on their side that the people must vote that way. Bobby didn't let that kind of consideration affect him, maybe because he didn't have terribly strong convictions himself. It was important to Lyndon Johnson that the information, Bobby's information, and the information he himself had collected on those long tally sheets, be accurate. Eyeglasses perched on his nose, he would hold a sheet in one hand, and the thumb of the other hand would move down the list of names, name by name, pausing on each line, making sure that no numbers were skipped or repeated, and that he knew, that each senator would vote as the sheet showed he would vote. The thumb moved very slowly. Sometimes it would pause by a name for quite some time while Lyndon Johnson reflected, and it would not move down to the next name until those reflections had been completed. The tall young senator standing with a tally sheet in hand, head bowed over it, sometimes seemingly lost in the numbers on the sheet, oblivious to the world around him, was a picture of concentration. He was a picture of determination, of a man resolved not to make a mistake. If these predictions of upcoming Senate votes were never complete, if the sheets usually contained more than a few blanks, they were nonetheless the best predictions available, by far. The White House learned that if it wanted to know what would happen if it pressed for a vote on some major administration measure, the best person to ask would be the assistant leader. Senators learned that if they wanted to know what would happen on a vote on some minor issue, some intrastate issue important only to them, the best person to ask would be the assistant leader. In the world of the Senate, in which for years now nobody had known what was going on, an awareness was gradually growing that now, at last, somebody did. Baker was also a source of other information, more routine but nonetheless vital. Votes needed not only to be counted, but to be produced. If an administration measure was coming up, it was the leader's responsibility to know where the bill's supporters could be reached, in their offices, at their homes, in a mistress's apartment, on the golf course, in a bar, so that they could be summoned to the floor in time to vote. More often than not, McFarland didn't know, but when he was back in Arizona, the responsibility fell to the assistant leader. Lyndon Johnson told Bobby Baker he wanted him to know the whereabouts of every Democratic senator at all times. Soon, recalls McFarland's administrative assistant, Roland Bibelet, whenever some senator went someplace, Bobby would always have a phone number where he could be reached, or where he couldn't be reached, and why he didn't want to be reached. During his 2 years as Democratic whip, Johnson forged a tool for his use, a tool perfectly fitted to his hand. The change in the whip's job was a matter of more than information. One of the majority leader's routine responsibilities was scheduling activities in the Senate's morning hour, the period, actually 2 hours long, at the beginning of each day's session, during which routine resolutions and petitions and certain unobjected-to bills could be introduced. With McFarland often in Arizona, and when he was in Washington uninterested in so mundane a chore, resolutions, petitions, and bills were piling up.
End of Disc 17.